Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
No, that isn't the new Politics on the Couch theme music. And no, you haven't stumbled upon a different podcast about indie rock from the late 90s. Some listeners will have recognised Whippin' Piccadilly from Gomez's Mercury Prize-winning debut album, Bring It On. At least I hope some listeners recognised it. But feeling nostalgic about the late 90s, while a bit of a recurrent theme in Politics on the Couch, is not a prerequisite for listening. So thanks all for downloading this festive episode. Festive in the minimalist sense that it's going out in December. Not much else that's Christmassy or seasonal about it. Oh, hang on a second. There you go. Sleigh bells. The musical theme is not the only way this episode is unusual. For a start, it's the first ever edition of Politics on the Couch to be recorded on an actual couch. A very comfortable couch in the studio belonging to Tom Gray, musician, campaigner, and aspiring politician. And that's the second unusual thing. Now, generally, we've made a point of not interviewing MPs for this podcast. There's enough of that sort of thing elsewhere. And also, serving politicians have to be careful about what they say. There are lines to stick to, party positions to navigate around. And too often, an interview becomes a game in which the journalist tries to trap the interviewee into saying what they really think in ways that count as indiscreet or controversial, and the interviewee has to sound sincere and candid without accidentally creating news. That's not what this podcast is about. But a recurrent theme in past conversations has been the question of what turns people, ordinary civilians if you like, into politicians. Are they a distinct species, or does something about the political process make them one? Is it a political character trait that draws people to submit themselves to politics, or is it a gradual metamorphosis? Does exposure to the machine create the political animal? By the way, this was the subject of a whole episode once, with social anthropologist Emma Crewe, so check that out in the Politics on the Couch archive. I'm presuming there's such a thing as a Politics on the Couch archive. I haven't actually checked, but I'm confident it exists. Anyway, in the spirit of scientific endeavour, we thought it might be interesting to get a sense of what turns people into politicians by speaking to someone on the very cusp of that transformation. A proto-politician, if you like. Enter Tom. He's had a hugely successful career in music. I mentioned Gomez rocketing to fame in 1998, beating Pulp and Massive Attack, among others, to the Mercury Prize. I'm not going to do the whole biography, discography thing here. We'll put some links in the podcast notes, and also there's the internet. I will, however, flag Tom's more recent Broken Record campaign, calling for a fairer deal for musicians from streaming services, among other industry reforms. And now, having banged on the doors to demand political change from the outside, Tom wants to get on the inside. He's on a shortlist to be selected as Labour's prospective parliamentary candidate for Brighton Pavilion. That's the only seat in the country with a Green MP right now. Caroline Lucas, although she's standing down at the next election. Now, this also happens to be the constituency I live in. So if, and it's a very big if, Tom is chosen to be Labour's candidate, and if, an even bigger if, Labour then go on to win the seat, Tom would be my MP. So there's a declaration of interest there, at least in the banal sense that I'm kind of interested to find out what he's like. Although that parochial aspect might well be irrelevant because by the time you hear this, someone else could be the candidate. But that's okay, because internal Labour politics is very much not the reason for having this conversation. Tom was invited onto the couch, well, technically his own couch, we invited ourselves onto his couch, because I was interested in what would make someone want to swap what looks to me like the perfect job, recording and performing music for eager fans, for the grim, thankless life of a politician, where I think it's safe to say the audiences are less than adoring. They look like such different worlds, but do they also have something in common? Performance is a key to both. Also, as we discussed, There's kind of a common tension in a need to come across as natural while repeating the same rehearsed lines many times over. And what about the creative impulse? Does that get suffocated by the need to satisfy an audience? Is commercial success in the music industry analogous in some way to popular appeal in politics, and do both require an element of betrayal? Selling out, in a word, or in two words. Are the duties and compromises required of being in a band, swallowing musical differences for the sake of the whole, comparable in some way to the requirement to hold a party line? These are the things, and more like them, that I wanted to discuss with Tom on the couch, his couch. But I started by asking whether, given what we know about the perceived weirdness of politics and how it's a life that seems to change people irrevocably, he felt at all trepidatious about the journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I feel entirely trepidatious. That's a very good description of it. We're all a little bit neurotic, aren't we? And it's, you know, taking a step into the unknown like this is tricky. But to be fair, I suppose most of the things I've done in my life have required a level of courage, which hasn't been, you know, entirely performative. It's, you know, it's you know, getting up on a stage in front of thousands of people isn't the easiest thing to do.
So, yeah, so performative is an interesting word there, because a huge element of politics is performance. You talked about being on stage.
Yeah.
You're projecting something out there that you want people to understand in a particular way, but you lose control of it the moment it's out there. Before, I want to talk about a little bit about, you know, how that actually works in politics as distinct from being creative. But probably in order to understand that better, we should just go back a stage, which is your motive for wanting to do this. Like, why would you, and we're sitting here in this fantastic studio surrounded by beautiful instruments and equipment, and I'm sitting here thinking, if I could do this for a living, if I was talented enough to be a musician and have this as my life, knowing what I know about what Westminster is like, nothing in the world would induce me to cross over. So just talk me through that.
I was interested in politics probably before I was interested in music. Or maybe they came at the same time. And maybe being from Merseyside, that's kind of innate to that to that culture. I don't know. But I joined the Labour Party when I was 15, and I started a band when I was 16.
Let's get some data. So that would have been, we're sort of pretty much contemporaries, aren't we? How old?
I was 15 in 1992. And in fact, I had decided...
Oh, you're a child. You're younger than me. Oh, you're a whippersnapper.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was quite precocious, though, and I decided that I was going to run in my, you know, my comprehensive school mock election in 1992 as the Labour candidate, and had decided that to be authentic, I should join the Labour Party, which I duly did.
So that's interesting, because that is peak sort of Labour incoming tide, new Labour. I mean, I remember that period so clearly. I'm a little bit older than you. But that feeling that has been, and it's been written about very well by many people, but that sense that it was just the default setting for the country seemed to be Labour in a way that, which actually isn't true. Lots of people voted Conservative in 1997, and obviously more people voted Conservative in 1992 than have ever voted for any one party in any election in UK British political history. So there are lots and lots of Tories in the mid-90s, and yet it just felt that this tide was coming in. It doesn't feel at all like that now, does it?
No. But then, you know, I won a mock election for Labour in a seat that was Lib Dem, actually, in Southport in 1992. So that's a strange world that we lived in then. The job has got a lot harder. I think the visibility of politicians has become a lot harder. I think message has become a lot harder. I think communications have become a million times more complex. But I don't know whether that really matters when it comes to the base reason of why we engage in politics.
Okay, so what is that then? So it's mid-90s, you're thinking you want to be in politics, but also you're in a band. Band massively takes off quite suddenly.
Uh-huh.
And where does political Tom Gray go at that point? What happens to that component?
Well, there's a funny little bit of it. Well, let me just rewind you a little here. I'd been working in Walworth Road, Labour Party HQ, age 17, licking stamps for Mo Molam and doing stuff like this. And very, very engaged in Labour Youth, or was it Young Labour by then? I forget. I go to university to study politics, politics and parliamentary studies in Leeds. And I'm supposed to go and work for a senator in my third year. This is what I'm supposed to do, which I was very excited about. But then suddenly, from nowhere, my band were going to get signed. Like, our tape had just been shared a million times and every label on the planet wanted to sign us.
You went viral before that was even a word.
Yes, we went viral with a cassette. And
underrated format, can I just say, the
deeply,
cassette.
Deeply.
Actually, not the sound is not as bad as people remember. Very handy, portable. I have profound affection for the cassette. And also forced you to listen to things you wouldn't necessarily listen to because you didn't want to waste your batteries fast-forwarding.
100%. And brilliant.
Pointless aside there.
No,
but
no.
That's a kind of content that Politics on the Couch listeners
no,
really
no,
appreciate.
No, I think they might. But the day sort of came, probably wasn't in an instant, but over the course of 2 months where I had to either get on a plane and go and work in Washington, D.C., or there was another option to get on Madonna's private jet and fly to New York because she was trying to sign us to Maverick.
Hard choice, yeah. I can see how that was a dilemma. Looking back, I can see it really was. But no, I can see how how old you were, about 20 years old at that point.
I was exactly 20 years old.
Yeah, so I can see how that didn't seem like a massive dilemma. And yet, so you join the Labour Party. So politics are of the left in some sense because you were raised, that's the family outlook, or you're a young person in the mid-90s, so self-evidently you're Labour. I mean, what? And then you just, I'm just getting that sense of like urgent enough that you want to be involved in the Labour Party, and they're yet also, this is going to sound perhaps unkind, but sort of in the background of just who you are enough that it can be submerged for...
Not submerged, because obviously I carried on campaigning for the Labour Party at varying elections all the way through and stayed an active member. But yeah, my day job became writing songs and then touring constantly. So, Gomez at their peak, 2004, 2005, we were playing 200 shows a year and most of them in North America. So I just wasn't here, really.
That is something I'm really interested in, that sense of being on the road, performing, projecting, which is what I mentioned earlier on. You have to deliver effectively the same show to lots of people over and over and over again, and ideally make them feel like it's the first time it's been done, that it's their unique version of that. There is something about that feels very analogous to being on a political campaign trail. I've been with a lot of politicians campaigning, and I've seen them do the same shtick many times, the same jokes, the same things, and to do it, you're a little bit on autopilot, but you can't look like you're on autopilot. That is quite a political skill.
It is a political skill, I suppose, and yet you do it, and you do it again and again and again. We played thousands of shows, and yeah, you can't let people see the weariness, the exhaustion behind the eyes.
The difference is when you're doing it with Gomez or as an artist, is it's your words, it's your creation that you're performing. And if you were to be an MP, there would be times when it's not.
Being in a band is a very, in fact, my band in particular was a very collaborative band. And we kind of dealt with the very democratic nature of our band by just going along with what each other's tastes were. I would frequently be playing songs every night that I wasn't a fan of. Because it was about doing it as well as you could do it, not necessarily doing it because you wanted to control it. That wasn't really what Gomez was as a creative vehicle, shall we say.
No, that's interesting. No, I suppose that makes sense, that ultimately, if it's within the ethos of the band and it's part of what you love about it is the creative process, then yeah, you can, I'm sure John Lennon wasn't a massive fan of Don't Pass Me By, but he thought, well, Ringo's got to do a song, right?
So, exactly right. There you go. I mean, that's precisely it. And so you're often having to sell something that you're not necessarily 100% spiritually connected to.
Yeah, okay, that's a diplomatic way of putting it. And this is why the scenario I'm envisaging, and there are many steps ahead potentially before you are functionally a politician in Westminster, we're at a very sort of proto stages here. There is a difference, isn't there, between a band member saying, I'd like to do this bluegrass reimagining of Come On Eileen or whatever, and you going, that's a terrible idea, and a whip turning up and saying, all right, Gray, I know that you campaigned very clearly on not banning chocolate, but we're got a three-line whip for banning chocolate bill and you're going to go and vote for it, aren't you? That's a different level of submerging your principles, your values, your choices for a greater political good, right?
That's submerging your individual values. I've always been a great believer in sort of collective effort and collective responsibility. I think the thing that we are most in danger of losing on the left is solidarity, and that with the sort of atomization of individual philosophy and identity politics, the path to equality and justice must be a negotiated one, right? We've all got to give a little bit of ourselves to get to the better place, I think.
And so that goes cycling back to the question I left hanging from earlier about actually why this, why now?
Mm-hmm.
That's a entirely noble but very abstract expression of your motivation. Is there a crunchier version of that that made you that is the answer to the question in 2023, this is why I want to be a Member of Parliament?
I've always just been deeply driven to try and sort out other people's problems. I've always done it my entire life. I get involved. I've never been able to watch somebody getting bullied. I've never been able to stay on the sidelines. I'm just not good at it. I'm too deeply invested in other people. I think music actually is fundamentally about empathy. And that's something that I truly believe in.
Okay, let's talk about that empathy and solidarity then, which I entirely, almost entirely agree that you're right, that is the core element that a left politics has to mobilise. And it's interesting, I put this to someone who is now in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet and said, you know, this is the theme, this is the sort of thing you should be talking about. And got quite an interesting sort of pushback, which was, yes, for the left. But to understand the resonance of that argument, you are already inhabiting a kind of cognitive space that romanticizes an idea of the left that actually you'll find is quite out of touch when you go and meet, for want of a better word, ordinary civilians, you know, normal people who haven't grown up with this idea that there is something with an uppercase L that is inherently noble. Most people don't get that. And an awful lot of people think the left just means slightly cranky, weird, you know, some combination of sandals, herbal tea, and not loving Britain and not wanting to sing the national anthem. Is that, you know, there's a harder bit that is telling people why, for example, so the expression of solidarity, one expression of solidarity is public services funded through general taxation. One way you do that, particularly at the moment when there's not enough money and there's not enough growth, is you've got to raise taxes. So saying what's missing is solidarity could also be a polite way of saying we've got to persuade people to pony up to pay more tax. That's not as easy, is it?
Yeah, of course it's not as easy. I mean, the difference between what my personal motivations are and what the motivations are of every other person in society, obviously there is a distinction, you know. But I always think that there's a reverse of every message, you know. There's always the other. If you're the kind of person who likes strongman politics, if you want to see someone standing up for the little guy, that requires a certain level of solidarity, right? But it's a very different type of message to how we arrive there. It's not about empathy. It's about you need somebody on your side. You need someone to stand up for you, which is, I think, a very straightforward political message.
In the third decade of the 21st century, how much does that message connect to traditional notions of class, which it feels to me is something that the Labour Party and left have found harder to talk about for a number of reasons, one of which is that the organised political Marxist project spectacularly imploded in 1989 and hasn't really sort of recovered from that. And the other one is that a lot of the base of the Labour Party is now middle class graduates and its traditional working class base. A lot of them, they voted for Brexit, voted for Boris Johnson, don't necessarily emotionally connect with the Labour Party in the way that traditionally through most of the 20th century they might have done.
Oh, well, that is a very difficult question. But I think, you know, we definitely have got a problem in terms of, I mean, the music industry as it is a very good example of how we've been going backwards on class. In order to succeed in the music industry now, you probably need the bank of mum and dad behind you, because there's no money in it. And we've driven all of the sort of working class out by making it impossible to make money at the lowest level. So you can't work your way up. So we've kind of cut them off. And that is fundamentally wrong.
It does feel like an aristocratization of something that used to be more democratic. When you and because I know you've campaigned obviously a lot on justice through streaming. When you look at the inverted pyramid of what's being streamed and who's making money off it, it is the most extraordinary kind of creative oligarchy. I don't know how much that actually compares to what it would have been like in, you know, with in the era of payola and control of the industry in the late 1950s, early 1960s.
It's not so much that everybody was making money, but there was a bigger functioning professional class, right? And they weren't necessarily rich. But this is the thing that I always talk about. I don't talk about a middle class in music, because the average earnings of a professional musician is about £20,000 per annum. We're talking about a low-paid sector, even if you're doing okay. So it's that loss of professional class that I think is really jarring and wrong, because musicians have an important role to play in society, and I think we kind of forget that. But that's an aside. Really, it's this sort of technological tide that has swept us up, which we're sold as a democratization, but is in fact the opposite. And that's one of the fundamentals that is really, really hard to understand. It's like everyone can engage, everyone can do it, everyone can make music cheaply, and yet nobody can make money from it, nobody can have a career from it, no one can rely on it.
And presumably the next stage of this gets even worse. I don't want to sound too bleak about it, but if the AI is currently scraping every bit of data that's out there, they are presumably currently hoovering up every semitone that Gomez ever played and feeding it into an algorithm, so that if I say, hey, GPT, can I have a sort of gritty, dirty, lo-fi blues rock sounds that's a bit like Gomez, but is about, you know, mint choc chip ice cream, it will do it for me. And you won't get a penny, even though it was the algorithm found your creative output and gave me my product.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that is coming over the hill. And, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to government, trying to sort this out and trying to get the policies clarified. And we're all trying internationally to move quickly to get in front of this, but it's near impossible. But for me, it's more like the lesson of the way technology is sold to us as democratizing us and engaging us. And the actual outcomes of it, where it feels less democratized and people feel more cynical and people feel less solidarity. There's an awful lot of counterintuitive things happening with the advancement of technology, social media.
That's interesting, isn't it? You're right. There's that synthetic sense of mutuality and sharing that doesn't actually strengthen the organic muscle fibers of social solidarity. So you can ping a tune that you like on Spotify to someone else and it feels like you're bonding, but somehow it's incredibly shallow. Interestingly, Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth, who I heard speaking the other day, and we were talking about this before we went on the podcast and our mutual sort of not actually being as into Sonic Youth as some people are-ness. But anyway, he was one thing that he said that was very interesting. I was about the importance, not just of, you know, it's a cliche that vinyl is special and there's a whole ritual to it and it has its own smell and its own crackle. And that's, you know, we all know, those of us who like records know that that is a thing. But actually, the physical process of giving someone a mixtape or a CDR that you've burnt and actually owning your own copy. So I don't own my music in a way that actually used to, and that sense of, this is a very elaborate thought that I've already lost, but that sense that a digital environment where you can feel you're connected with lots of people is completely ethereal and evanescent, and you're not actually doing that analog network.
Absolutely, this is entirely counterintuitive reality, which is that physical things are more symbolic. At the centre of all human ritual are physical things. And you know, communion
That was exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, there's a sort of sacramental element of, and then which comes back to actually, you know, when you talk about getting involved in politics, you talk about licking envelopes, you know, and stamps. Ideally, licking the stamps more than the envelopes. I say, well, no, you used to have to lick envelopes as well. Definitely not licking anything else. Hopefully, the sense that, you know, there is and people talk about shoe leather, you know, working through the soles of your feet to literally knock on doors. That aspect of politics is so sort of underrated and undervalued, and so as important to having an actual functioning democracy as the act of voting or any of the other things that people more commonly think of as what politics is about.
Absolutely. And what is, you know, this word engagement that is used all the time, just thrown around like it's meaningful when somebody actually clicks on a tweet and then actually reads it. Well, that's, I wouldn't say somebody's entirely engaged at that point, but, you know, somebody being involved in a process, physically trying to do something, being present in a room, you know, with an agenda, trying to move the needle on social justice, collective endeavor, you know, that feels real to me. It feels meaningful.
Yeah, it's politics as gig rather than politics as...
And maybe my politics do go back to, you know, being an altar boy in a Catholic church and also being like the son of a Jewish woman and being taken to temple and sitting through multiple varying rituals of two different faiths in communal areas. I don't know.
Yeah, it was interesting that you reached for sacrament. And yeah, I was thinking, like, communion, presumably as an altar boy. Did you ever eat the body of Christ as a Jewish boy growing up in Liverpool? Were you not? I'm pretty sure you weren't supposed to.
No, I'm actually raised Roman Catholic. So I'm a secular Jew, Roman Catholic, secular Jew. Mix.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you feel guilty about everything.
Oh, mate, I can do guilt like you have no idea.
Excellent. Well, you're going to have to jettison that if you become a politician. You're going to have to develop unbelievably sort of self-confident, thick skin that basically makes you think if it goes wrong, it's because you were badly advised. It was someone else's fault. You can't start blaming yourself. You know, do you think Rishi Sunak blames himself?
Well, I've been a musician for many years, so maybe there's a bit of narcissist in there too, so we'll see.
I think there isn't, and it has to be an element of that. I'm not going to go into, do you believe in God now?
My line is always, you know, being a Roman Catholic Jew will make an atheist out of anyone.
That's a good position to have. We talked about the knocking on doors, ground level engagement.
Yeah.
I slightly skirted over the campaigning stuff you've done, and you mentioned trying to get government to change. And again, on this podcast, I've just talked a lot about what politics looks like or feels like for the people who are making the laws on the inside. This is, you know, what's happening in the House of Commons, and actually not very much about what it looked like to you as someone with a proposed change or a demand for reform banging on the door. With some effect. So, you know, you weren't just sort of there. You weren't, you know, like the guy who sits in Parliament Square shouting through a loudhailer. I mean, you know, fair play to him. But, you know, your approach was a little bit more sophisticated, I think I could probably say. Talk me through how that actually works, what that feels like when you're saying, you've got a message, which is, in this case, the streaming system is basically ripping off artists. It's not working. Uh-huh. The pandemic wrecked the livelihoods of lots of people. There's a demand, legislative change at some level or regulatory change. How do you get from that feeling to, and now I'm in a room with people who might be able to change that? Well, what does that actually feel like, interfacing with politics from that angle?
It is a hard question. It might be better to just make it a little bit more narrative. I think I've been working sort of in the back rooms of varying associations, working for creators, songwriters, artists for a few years, helping them sort of become professionalized around policy and public affairs. Because once I stopped touring when my son was quite young and I decided I was going to be a bit more of a stay-at-home dad and be a composer for TV and stuff, and I realized I sort of had this superpower of have a politics in my back pocket. So I thought, well, I ought to use that for my friends, really. I ought to give them that.
When you say the superpower, does that mean actually understanding how it works or what it is?
Fully understanding.
In an environment where maybe lots of people don't actually...
Yeah, really knowing how Westminster works A lot of the people who I came through the Labour Party with in my youth ended up working in Parliament, being MPs, you know, all kinds of stuff, being lobbyists, becoming journalists. I mean, it's if you start young enough in politics, that just becomes part of your network. And I was sort of, for a lot of them, I was like a weird kid brother who got into music, you know, what's he doing kind of thing. How come that's happened to him? We thought he was going to be a policy wonk like the rest of us. So, I was helping these organisations professionalise, had sort of designed what a sort of standard policy-driven campaign would look like for these organisations on streaming, which was already a problem pre-pandemic, right? So this was already on paper, basically. What changed with the pandemic was in the February of that year was I could just see what was ahead of us. I knew that musicians were going to be stuck at home. They weren't going to be able to play gigs. And if they weren't able to play gigs, they wouldn't have any money. I also work on licensing, so I sit on the board of PRS, so I knew, which is, you know, the people who give money for hairdressers and the rest, you know, to play music all day. I knew that licensing money would disappear if all those businesses closed. So I just had this extreme prescient sense of, like, this is what's coming. And so we have to go now. We have to start talking now, because there are two things, you know, and it wasn't cynical, you know, can't let a good crisis go to waste kind of thinking. It was more, oh my, I can't remember a time in my life where musicians have all been at home near their computers. There's an opportunity there to organise people that I don't think has ever happened before in music. So I seized upon it. And I went back to the organisations and said, can we go now? Can we start? And they all went, no, we're not ready. We're big organisations. We need to file this and get that passed by that committee and all the rest. And I went, okay, well, I'll just start a guerrilla campaign. And Broken Record began right there.
At the point where you're then meeting people who can change stuff,
yeah,
politicians, what was the highest level meeting you had? Who were, did secretaries of state? What, where, how far did you get? And yeah, what was the top level interface you had with government on this?
Talking to Nadine Dorris directly.
Who was then Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport.
Yes, she was, yeah.
And did you get a sense that Nadine Dorris grasped the issues?
Obviously realised Nadine Dorris was an author, and I explained to Nadine that if we change copyright law to benefit songwriters, it would also benefit authors. And as soon as she
that's
heard...
That's some good politics right there. That's politics there. That's the politics on the couch content that we're looking for. That's how it works.
As soon as she heard that, she was very interested in addressing copyright law.
Copyright law is ferociously complicated, and we are not going to go any deeper into that on this podcast.
But also, you know, speaking to Number 10, to senior policy people in Number 10, I mean, it blew my mind when we got the first select committee inquiry and then being asked to sit at that. That was the most like, oh, right, I've really done it now.
And that stoked the appetite for thinking, oh, I'd like to be one of those people. I'd like to be doing that. Or not, was there not an element of thinking, this is the most grindingly hellish thing in the world, why would I stick my head in that particular bucket of
I found I had the opposite experience. It just gave me more energy. It was just more fuel to the fire. It was like, well, if I can do that, I can probably get more things to happen. And so I did. And so, you know, I wrote a letter to Boris and got like 200 odd of the biggest stars in the country to co-sign a letter with the Musicians Union, which, you know, I don't think that's ever happened before. Asking for reform. We got the Competitions and Markets Authority to study the music industry. I helped coordinate a private members bill with Kevin Brennan, which we put on the floor of the House.
Kevin Brennan, who was briefly in MP4, the House of Commons band.
He still is in MP4. In fact, they played just the other day.
I thought they split in the late 10s because the cross-party thing just couldn't work because of how poisonous it was.
No, they just celebrated their anniversary. Fergal Sharkey introduced them onto the stage just as he did when they first played their first ever show. Yeah, Kevin's very important to my story because without Kevin picking up on my campaigning and becoming a campaigner on the inside at the same time as me campaigning on the outside, it wouldn't have been possible.
That inside-outside duality is an interesting one because, again, going back to street level, you, as we speak, you're not even necessarily on the shortlist of prospective candidates in a seat where Labour are in opposition.
Yes.
So there are an awful lot of stages that you have, you'd have to go through to go from where you are now to being sitting on one of those green benches. And it's possible that you could be more effective, more efficiently by carrying on doing it the way you've been doing it rather than... So just maybe just talk us through in broad terms, or as granular as you like, actually, the fiddly, weird, long process that is actually involved between thinking, I'd quite like to be an MP, and how, so, and then one day you actually are being sworn in. Because it's all, actually, I think a lot of people don't appreciate how arcane and weird and ritualistic and protracted and hard and expensive that process actually is.
I think it's worth saying before I say that, that running a campaign that goes global from your laptop and taking it through Parliament and co-authoring bills and appearing before select committees and dealing with parliamentary clerks and all of the rest of the things that I've done on the outside is not simple. Far, very, very far from it. And I'm retaining the, you know, a wide communications network with all the major newspapers and the radio stations, you know, by yourself.
And leading politics podcasts.
And leading politics podcasts is yes, sorry, that's very important to say, is not easy. And actually, one of the attractions of politics is the fact that there'll be people helping me. Yes, becoming an MP, which I am, as you say, very, very far away from becoming right now, is ridiculously hard. There are, it's not really all written down somewhere, so you're sort of having to guess your way through it a bit and make a lot of phone calls and getting slightly different answers from all sorts of different people. The Labour Party process, effectively, you apply and then you wait to hear, and then you, there's a period of time where you have can seek endorsements and nominations from unions and socialist societies. So you have to be speaking to them constantly and trying to engage them in being interested in you and talking to them and sending dozens and dozens of statements about yourself to lots of different people, catering to their interests and or framed for their interests, rather. And it's you feel quite alone. It's a very strange, lonely road.
And you yourself were saying earlier that you grew up, you know, in this milieu. You had lots of friends who you could call and message and go, how on earth do I do this? Is this the right thing? Should I say this to this person? Would that be a terrible idea? I imagine lots of those conversations went on, which is a useful resource to have. And coming at it without that, it must just be completely, you'll just be looking at this huge, high, sheer wall with no handholds. You just... How would anyone even begin to think that that was something that they might want to be able to do?
It's wild. And you know, I'm very lucky to have a big network of people in politics who have all offered bits of advice and help and put me in touch with people. And that is a wealth and a privilege, frankly. But there's a whole other side to it, which I was just the other day thinking, how does anyone do this if they're not a creative? I built a website, designed a website, did all of the graphics in the website, did a candidate video that I had to pull together and script and write and put music on. And I mean, these are all things that if you are just new to all of that stuff, you're just going to be at the whim of lots of other people, whoever you can beg a favour from, or whatever little money you can scrape together to do it. I mean, all of that's been really easy for me because that's just what I do.
It's one of the really interesting bottlenecks in politics in terms of actually how, you know, deciding what the components of a parliament are, who actually gets represented in the parliament. And that's not unique to Labour at all. I mean, every party has its own version of this phenomenon. You know, and at the same time, if you're the party leader, you're thinking, well, that's a very useful bottleneck for me because it creates opportunities for me to go, No, not these people. Or, you know, the leader's office has control over shortlists. The Conservative Party, they keep control over, you know, who are the approved candidates for winnable seats and these sorts of processes. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of stuff about the suggestion that Keir Starmer and his office are working very, very hard to make sure that the next parliamentary Labour Party is full of eager, keen, obedient Starmerites, because the last thing they need is a sudden influx of 60 wild, rebellious, independent spirits who will just make life difficult for them. And I can understand why they would think that, but it doesn't feel very democratic.
Was there a question in there?
My question there was, I'm inviting you to observe whether or not you think that is a fair account of the way the selections process has been working.
I mean, that hasn't been my experience at all. I mean, I'm generally considered in my industry to be a rebel, I think. It's fair to say. I'm generally quite hated by the institutions within my...
That's also a useful skill to have in politics. Get used to being hated.
Get used to being hated. Because if you challenge powerful people, strangely, they don't like it so much. But then, you know, my politics are quite pragmatic, so maybe that does fit into that a bit. I don't know. It's a very strange one for me. I mean, and also Eddie Izzard is involved. Eddie, or Susie, as she is in the pub, she doesn't fit into that very straightforward version of who gets to be in a Labour Party process. So it's
but also brings name recognition, brings a network. You know, I can see if you were just a small-time local councillor, not necessarily in Brighton, but anywhere in any constituency in the country, or just a parent at the school gate thinking, mm-hmm. I'm angry about the state of the everything. Maybe actually a way I could make a difference would be to try and become an MP. You've basically got no chance, have you? There's no way in.
I don't know if that's true, but then that's... You know, I'm not observing the entire system like you are, maybe. I really don't have a global view of it. I've been too busy worrying about whether I can get leaflets printed on the right day. If they tell me on the day that I am shortlisted and I can get them in envelopes fast enough and things like that. You know, it really is very boringly practical, the process of becoming a selected candidate. It's a lot of drudgery, really.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, having to frame the way you say things to certain audiences, understand that, yeah, there's going to be a difference between the message that really pushes buttons and turns lights on for a local Labour Party meeting is going to be different to the one that you would do for swing voters who might be thinking they're weighing up between Labour and Greens or between Labour and Tory or whatever it is. And that process in itself means you must always be at some level calibrating, mediating the words between your brain and your mouth, which is, I think, one of the important differences between the way politicians communicate and the way most people talk most of the time. You know, so for example, are you doing that right now?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is, you're already now in sort of proto-politician mode, expressing yourself in a way that you wouldn't have done 6 months ago.
No, because I would have done it 6 months ago as well. And of course, you know, if you grow up in a media environment as a musician, being interviewed by, I don't even remember what the music press was like in the late 90s and early noughties, but it was quite vicious. And you had to be quite careful about what you said to get the wrong headline.
Yeah, that's true. If you accidentally said, oh, I'm not a massive fan of the new Oasis record, then it's suddenly, you know, Gomez guy slams Oasis, big spat, big feud, and then suddenly Liam Gallagher's calling you a twat on a radio.
I actually had to hold Liam back from chinning. Who was it? Oh, I had to hold him back from chinning.
Noel, probably.
No, it wasn't Noel. It was a lad from that band from were they from Bolton or Wigan or somewhere? They were called like Star Sailor. Yeah, they were named after a Tim Buckley album, which I always found strange because they didn't sound very much like Tim Buckley. I don't know what had gone on. All I knew was Liam was getting overexcited.
And I wonder why. but no, that point, it's interesting though, because, you know, I mean, I do know that experience I've done broadcast as well. At the most basic level, I know not to swear on the BBC at lunchtime or even after 10 o'clock if I'm talking about politics. Well, generally not. But at some level, I'm fascinated by, if you do that enough, what cognitively it's actually doing to your ability to articulate things candidly, and what constitutes authenticity in politics becomes this kind of weird paradoxical thing of, can you simulate authenticity well?
I think what you're not accounting for is the fact that people experience messages in different ways, right? So there's obviously that dissonance there as well. So no matter how authentically you say something, somebody may not hear it authentically. If you really want someone to hear you, you're going to have to calibrate your tone and your message, because that is just people. And I mean, music's the same thing. When you're trying to give somebody something that they feel and experience as new or interesting, it may not actually need to be all that new and interesting to get there. It just needs to be some combination formally that they're not necessarily used to that gives them something else.
And it is interesting also that there is that combination between, or that paradoxical thing of having to capture in an artificial and controlled environment something that is live and spontaneous. And it has to, you listen to the extraordinary thing about those early Beatles recordings is, that you had George Martin controlling it, and they did dozens of takes, but they did enough takes, and yet somehow it contains something incredibly organic. And I think that combination of craft and artifice that isn't so artificial that it just comes across as completely desiccated and sterile. There is an analogy there somewhere, I think, maybe.
Well, I think it's to do with capture, isn't it? It's capturing something so that people sense it, they feel it in that capture. It's who is the author? The person making the sound or the person controlling the sound? It's a very blurry line there. It's very interesting, really, because you can't capture the Beatles being that amazing unless you have George Martin in the room, unless you have a scientist of recording,
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose also, Hemingway is always reputed to have said, I think it might be apocryphal, that you write drunk and edit sober, and there's an element of that, I suppose, in music as well, that you just have to sort of let it all hang out up to a point, but you still need the control. And I wonder also in politics, exactly that sense of how do you capture authenticity, I suppose, at its best when it's working, or charisma when it's working, is somewhere in that combination of actually studied and controlled. There's something feral and wild that's appealing on a kind of an atavistic animal level, but has actually also been organised and controlled very cleverly.
Yeah. So, I mean, something we always used to talk about in Gomez is like, when just before you do a take, is like that sense of trying to put that sense of abandon in. So it's like you've learned it a million times, but in that exact moment, you have to somehow become unhinged.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to be interested to know whether there's any read across there in politics. Actually, Enoch Powell, who we've never cited in any way approvingly on this podcast before for very good reasons, but he famously said that to deliver a good political speech, the key thing is to have a big drink of water before you go, so you're desperate for a wee before you speak. So you've got that kind of, that's like, what? Like, I've got to get through this because actually I'm about to wet myself. I don't think he expressed it like that, and it might be apocryphal, but maybe there is something in that as well. You've got to try and, like, if you ever lose the adrenaline, if you ever lose the sense of fear, then you're going to be complacent and it's going to come across like that.
Right now, I'm an absolute ball of nerves. In fact, just forming sentences right now is very, very difficult for me because I'm just waiting to hear if I've made the shortlist up for the Labour selection. And if I have, then the next couple of weeks of my life are probably going to be a bomb site.
That stress and tension is important, but also focused, going back to this point about calibrating for different audiences, in a very specific milieu. And there's lots of steps. And by the time people get this podcast, you might or might not be at the next stage of this complicated process. Then suddenly you've got to as it were, sort of lift your head up and address Brighton and Hove Pavilion. And also, sorry, important declaration of interest here, which I think I must do for this podcast. I'm a constituent in that in Brighton and Hove Pavilion seat. So I would be voting in that election and potentially you would be my MP were you to be successful. Currently, Caroline Lucas is the MP. She's standing down. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird contest in that sense because Labour Green has all sorts of very different dynamics, obviously, to almost any other seat in the country. Yeah. And I think there would probably be a lot of people outside Brighton who would think, why is the Labour Party even wasting time and money trying to win that seat? It's never going to be a Tory seat. And like, we like, you know, environment, green, that's good, right? You know, that will be a general broad progressive view from outside. What on earth would you be doing trying to unseat the only green MP in Parliament?
The message for people outside of Brighton is that people in this city have experienced, admittedly, minority green local councils on and off for quite a long time. And they have been noteworthy for their failure and their incompetence. And at the last local elections, they were completely thrown out. Labour swept the board. Caroline stepping down at this exact moment, I wouldn't dare to suggest that there was that might have helped some of her thinking about why she might want to move on now. I've seen MRP polling recently in Pavilion that puts Labour 16 points ahead of the Greens. Me personally, why do I think this is important? If somebody can take the mandate at Brighton Pavilion, a seat that has this long history of environmentalism and climate agenda, and turn it red, that is an extraordinary platform for a Labour MP. What's really missing is the clear path to substantive change, real statutory, regulatory change. And being able to drive that from somewhere like Brighton Pavilion, because of its nature, because of its reach, because of its hugely metropolitan and well-connected population, that I think is a huge opportunity for somebody. And, you know, so when I started, obviously, this didn't come up until the day I heard Caroline Lucas was standing down. And when that happened, all my friends just started ringing my phone saying, are you going to do this? Because you always said you were going to do it if one of the Brighton seats came up or seemed possible. And so I just started finding out how it was possible or if it could be done. And the more I just have carried on down that path. And then, you know, I started talking to Labour Campaign for the Environment and talking to Fergal Sharkey and talking to these different organisations who I know.
Fergal Sharkey, I've been very active on the sewage, well, against rather, sewage being dumped into the water, right?
Yes.
Which is presumably an issue here because I, for one, know that I like to swim in the sea and I don't like the idea of it being full of, I was about to say, other people's shit. Even my own shit would be in
yeah, yeah.
not something I'm able to swim in. So anyone's.
I got E. coli swimming in the sea last year. I was in bed for 2 days. It was really grim. People, you know, this rhetoric about a green voice in Parliament, the parliamentary system we've got, that is just meaningless. There is to drive power, to drive change, to move the conversation. I know being in Parliament, being a Labour MP who has got in there on the platform of regulatory change around, you know, very, I mean, with the water companies, it's that has just gone unchallenged for so long. It's wild. I mean, what they're getting away with is outrageous. And when you,
what is the current Labour position on nationalising those buggers now? Because I have to say, I've always come at this from a sort of broad, I suppose, for want of a better term, liberal centre-left point of view. And I've been on a journey, like a lot of people, towards thinking, yeah, I get that it's kind of complicated, but actually, if you're going to nationalise any privatised utility, I've got my sights on those guys. So remind me what I've actually
well,
now.
We're not. The national position isn't there yet on renationalisation. Any Labour government coming in, the first thing that we're going to need is a successive Labour government, right? We're going to need more than one Labour government, aren't we? The level of change that we need in this country, one isn't going to do. And if we're all right that there's no money to be spent and we can't borrow anymore because of the scale of the debt versus, you know, GDP and all the rest of these arguments that are trotted out, The changes that you can make that are substantive, which are quick and are free, are regulatory. And the opportunity is there to come down hard on these companies and quick.
Now, going back to this question of red on green, that being a slightly unusual contest, I speak at quite a lot of political events just because I get invited locally as a Guardian columnist, and spoken at Labour events, Green events, Lib Dem events. Strangely, the Tories are never called.
Get worried when they do.
This is a very, very long way away from that. But the one thing that routinely comes up when you're ever in a room full of progressive voters who are engaged is that point about, you know, why does the electoral system we're in make us sort of hate each other more than we need to? And particularly, we're not very far away from Lewis. That is a Tory seat because basically Labour people refused to vote Lib Dem because they were still bitter about the coalition. Mm-hmm. And that then people voted Green. It gets complicated, but it's not, in quotes, a big doorstep issue outside politics, but PR and electoral reform, I guarantee you, in the rooms where really engaged political people in sort of progressive circles meet.
Electoral reform, I'm certainly interested in. Proportional representation, or some version of proportional representation, is very interesting to me. But as it stands, we do have a first-past-the-post system. And the problem with that means is that the Greens do just split the progressive vote. It's just a fact, because we are in that system. Now, go to PR. Yeah, the Greens can have all the fun they like, you know, but we don't live in that world. This is the problem. It's like the difference between the politics of idealism and the politics of realism. And I would firmly put myself, even though I am quite a romantic and there is a part of me that's highly idealistic, in terms of the practice of politics, I'm very much a realist.
That sense of the idealism, that relationship between idealism, pragmatism, can be made analogous to that process we described about the sort of the feral, impulsive, creative urge and then the production side, you know, so John and Paul going nuts and then George Martin getting on the desk and cleaning it up.
There's always the idea and then the process, and then what you get at the end of the process is different from the idea. It's never identical to the idea. That is the creative process. Every creative process is a failure. By its own, you know, if you judge it by the original idea, right?
Can confirm, yes. Someone has written a book recently. Yeah, right,
precisely that. I mean, so, and that's the same as politics, isn't it? Really, politics is the practical path of an idea. How much of the idea can you keep as you go through the filter, the process? And okay, maybe you don't retain all of it, and maybe you lose parts, and maybe you have to modulate it in some way. But of course, you know why you started down the path, right?
I like that analogy. It's true that there is certainly the thing that's finally produced in any creative endeavor, and often in any long project, never resembles the sort of pristine concept you had in your head when it was conceived. But that doesn't necessarily mean it is a betrayal of that, because you have to recognize, it's like Samuel Johnson said, and I won't remember the exact quote, but basically, you know, perfection is something you hold in your head as a guide to navigate you. That doesn't mean you're ever going to achieve it. If you're not, you navigate by the stars. You don't think I'm literally going to reach the North Star. Mm-hmm. You just have it there, so you know that you're going in the right direction. And that distinction, that for me, I mean, I know you don't like using the word centrist, but that for me is an important part of, you know, reasonable, practical, liberal, democratic politics, is that we recognise that distinction, that you go, well, you can be idealistic, but you're not on a sort of hair trigger to cry treason and betrayal when someone says, well, we're not going to do exactly the fulfilment of the perfect ideal, because actually we have to work with real voters and real politics in a real country.
Absolutely. It's a negotiation. And you know, negotiation is one of the tools of the politician, right? So it for me, I just don't understand the other version of that.
Well, I suppose and it's a point to his credit, I think, and I've been critical of Keir Starmer, but I think he gets this right, that always pointing to that difference between being a party of protest and being a party of government. Conceptually, they are very different things.
I mean, I completely agree with that, because people have to believe that there is a practical reality awaiting them. There will be substantive change, which is precisely what, you know, my own argument with the Green Party is here. You know, it's not, I don't hate the Greens. They all seem like nice liberal people, as you say, who seem to care about a lot the same things as me. but I don't believe them when they say they're going to do something.
Would it be fair to say you resist labels like left, centre-left, centrist, liberal, moderate in the way that you would resist genres like hard rock, blues?
Yeah, they feel like genres. It's like people define themselves and then stay within their genre. I'm very rebellious against anybody describing me as one thing or another thing. When I made music, one of the things that I suppose Gomez is probably best known for is refusing to make music that anyone categorised or could be categorised.
Yeah, it's like I got my... I don't want to mention the demon streaming service on this podcast, but I did get my Spotify Unwrapped thing that they do the other day, and other streaming services are available. And also, so is just going out and buying records available, by the way. Everyone, please go and do that. Right, that's important to get that out there. But it describes you, it segments what you've been listening to in terms of genres. And I literally hadn't heard of one of the genres they claimed I'd been listening to quite a lot. I don't even know what that is. And Spotify thinks I've been listening to a lot of it. So apparently I'm that. But yes, I think it's a good comparison.
Well, I think a lot of the way that we format things and format conversation and format genre and format debate is actually designed for marketing and designed for the media and designed so that we can access audiences and we can, you know, we can spend money efficiently when we're trying to reach those audiences. And a lot of it is just, it's not real. It really isn't real. And in fact, it's this whole problem of the fact that people aren't hearing messages which are outside of their echo chamber, all of, you know, the classic algorithmic kind of Ouroboros that we all seem to live in. Now, it's that for me is the worst part of the modern world. It's the very worst part. And you and everybody, like, it's hilarious. People getting radicalized. It's like, the centrist dads have become radicalized about their centrist daddishness. You know, it's like, it's ridiculous. We are whatever we choose, whatever we, you know, some days I get out of bed and I don't want to eat vanilla ice cream. You know, it's just...
I'm going to segue elegantly here into... It's been a long, hard year. Tom Gray, what have you been listening to?
The album that came out this year that I've listened to the most is Everything Harmony by the Lemon Twigs. That kind of stayed with me, that record. Kept going back to it. Very interesting, plaintive, kind of old school record they made. It's very beautiful, actually. Don't know if you've listened to it.
No, I will do now. What are you looking forward to about 2024 then? Creatively, I'm not talking about not the politics, nothing about 2024.
Well, I've been working for about 2 years on adapting Danny Champion of the World for the Roald Dahl Story Company, and it'd be really wonderful if I managed to get that finally up on its feet on the stage next year. That would be a wonderful thing to see.
That is my favourite Roald Dahl book.
It's everyone's favourite Roald Dahl book.
Is it though? Actually,
no,
isn't.
It's not.
No, it's not. A lot of people, it's not. The Chocolate Factory.
Men of a certain age.
Yeah.
it's literally not
everyone's favourite Roald Dahl.
I know. It was my favourite one when I was a kid. Loved it. And it's the beautiful central relationship between a father and son is a real rarity in literature, any literature, and you know, a deeply non-toxic male relationship.
Yeah, and it wasn't my favourite as a kid, but it was my favourite as a parent to read to my kids, probably for that reason. And also what I like about it is there's no supernatural element in it, unlike a lot of the Roald Dahl things where... And I love the fantasy stuff and the weird stuff that happens in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory or Matilda's strange, you know, supernatural gift that she appears to have. But Danny Champion of the World, as you say, it's just the drama hinges on relationships and action in the material.
It's all about power and... sticking it to the man and, you know, the evil, you know, landowner who's ruining the life of all the villagers. I can't imagine, understand why that appeals to me.
And direct action as well.
And direct action.
Right, on that note, I think we should probably call it a day because we've used up a lot of your time.
Brilliant.
And you've got other things on your mind.
I hope I wasn't too space age with all the nerves.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Just to let you know, about an hour after that conversation ended last Friday, Tom Gray finally found out he'd made it onto the shortlist of Labour Party prospective parliamentary candidates for the Brighton Pavilion seat the next time it's in play, which is most likely the next general election. Now, even though 99% of our listeners won't be eligible to vote for the next PPC for that seat, as one does need to be a Bryant Pavilion Labour Party member, in the spirit of fairness, I will name the other candidates in the running. They are Birgit Miller, a Brighton & Hove Labour councillor, Lucy Hellowell, also a Brighton & Hove Labour councillor, and Eddie Izzard, a comedian and actor. And the winner is due to be announced around 15th of December. I hope you enjoyed this crossover episode. I'm off to listen to the new Lemon Twigs album that Tom recommended. And also, finally, because of the musical theme running through this edition, I've been asked to give a big shout out to the Porto Primavera crew who listen to every episode of this podcast. Well, at the very least, a chap called Chip says he does. I'm Philip, the producer. You've been listening to Politics on the Couch. Until next time.